funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does raising children detract from happiness? The question strikes many parents as counterintuitive, if not outright ridiculous. We love our children with all our hearts, and once they come into our lives, we can scarcely imagine a world without them. But as my guest today will tell us, there is a difference between loving your children and loving the act of parenting them. In fact, research shows that from moment to moment, parents report significantly more unhappiness than their peers without kids. And the culprit may not be the kids themselves, but the way we define our own responsibilities to them in 21st century America. Jennifer Senior is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Her new book is called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Jennifer, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So you're a mother yourself. What made you start asking these third rail questions about whether that role made you more or less happy?
You know, I wasn't actually attracted to them when I became a mother. I actually first ran across this very robust finding in the social sciences that kids do not improve their parents' happiness when I was still a single girl. I took one look at that, and it's very robust. I mean, replicated in study after study. It's even found when people aren't looking for it. And when I found this out, my response was, whoa, I want to interrogate this. It seems both right and really wrong. But I was afraid that if I actually investigated it right then and there, there would be a huge credibility gap between me and any reader looking at this thing, because they would be like, what does she know? She doesn't have kids. So I had to wait until I had them. But I always found this data really puzzling, and it was the jumping off point, obviously, for my book, which tried to look much more broadly at how kids affect their moms and dads.
Well, tell us about how social scientists measure happiness and what changes depending on whether they're looking at overall satisfaction as compared with, say, minute-to-minute experiences.
That is a wonderful question, and methodology certainly plays a big role in this. So here are a few things to bear in mind. One way that a social scientist can measure happiness is moment-to-moment they can sort of ask you what it is that you're doing and how you like it. And in fact, Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel Prize, did a very famous study in 2004 that essentially did that. He didn't actually go with people throughout their day, but at the end of the day, he had 909 women in Texas, actually, sit down and block out what they had done in like 15-minute increments or so and describe how they felt about it. Were they happy? Were they bored? Were they nervous? Were they depressed? A big range. And at the end, what he found is that mothers rated taking care of their kids 16th out of 19 in terms of daily activities. And they didn't know that they were rating it like this. They were not consciously going in with an attempt to try and figure out how much they liked child care. But it seemed that the pressures associated with it were so great that it was actually easier to vacuum. I mean, vacuuming was above this. So that is one way you can do it. You can kind of try and evaluate it moment to moment. There's a flaw in this, I am now going to tell you, because think about it. If I go out with a group of friends and I am asked on a scale of 1 to 5 how I found it, and I give it a 5 because it was a great night, mm-hmm. That's great. But if I am looking into my kid's eyes at 2 in the morning and my kid is a newborn and he coos for the first time and looks at me with this sense of recognition that, oh, you are going to be one of the most crucial people in my life. That's unrivaled, right? That's something almost akin to religious awe. But what am I allowed to give it?
A 5.
Right? Yeah.
Same as margaritas with the girls.
Yeah. Exactly. So, I mean, it's a little bit like Amazon rankings. You know, I mean, 50 Shades of Grey gets a lot of 5s, and so does Anna Karenina. Mm-hmm. And you and I both know that they are very different kinds of 5s. And so I think in some way something that's missing sometimes. So if social scientists started measuring moments of awe or moments of transcendence, I'm very curious whether they'd find that parents have more of them. And when they measure meaning, they do find that parents have more meaning in their lives. And a recent study also showed that parents have more highs and more lows in their lives, which makes much more sense to me that they recruit from this big emotional range.
It's also worth noting that for this book, you're looking largely at this issue from the perspective of middle-class families, recognizing that things may be very different if you're quite wealthy, and things are certainly different if you are really struggling to keep body and soul together.
I am so glad you pointed that out. Yes. The problem with writing about poor parents is that the problems of parenting are inseparable from the problems of poverty. Mm-hmm. And you can't really write a book about one without writing a book about the other. So I had to, in good conscience, not address that. I think poor parents deserve their own book, and so do books about poverty. I just couldn't really go there. And at the other end of the range, yeah, I mean, you can outsource a lot if you have a lot of money, so that you might not have to stay up in the middle of the night, and you might not be as tortured by how is my kid going to remain in this ever-shrinking middle-class world that we live in, and, you know, how am I going to balance spending money on soccer lessons, but also on, you know, a tutor for math. It's a different thing. So all the kids in my school, with almost no exceptions, I guess there was maybe one, went to public schools. I mean, I didn't even have that many upper middle class parents in my book. It was really the middle of the middle.
So we have learned that we're not very good at predicting what will make us happy or unhappy. What kinds of changes do we imagine that children will bring to our lives before we actually have them?
I think, if you look at Facebook and see how meticulously people's family pictures are curated, mm-hmm. if you don't have a kid, you might expect family life to look like that. You know, I'll never forget around Halloween, there were all these really terrific pictures in my Facebook feed of kids smiling very happily in a pumpkin patch. Mm-hmm. What those pictures didn't show you was, like, maybe the meltdown that they had in the car, right, on the way over to the pumpkin patch, or that they didn't really like the pumpkins, or that they were tired and didn't want to keep walking, or whatever it is that they were. The issue for people who have gone to college is that they wait now. A woman, if she has a college degree, waits on average until she is 30.3 years old to have a child. So you have to imagine that, first of all, she's grown accustomed to a lot of her autonomy, mm-hmm. and same with her, you know, a man. But also think about how much you expect from the experience of having a kid if you're waiting that long. Like, you're going to be infusing it with all this hope and all these high expectations because it's the very last thing you do. You have already presumably gotten married, found your job, found your house, and then you have the kid. So it's only natural, because of where it falls chronologically, for you to think it's going to be just great, the way that heroines in Jane Austen novels thought that marriage was going to be just great, you know, but we all know that marriage is complicated and a very mixed bag, and so is raising kids.
How have our definitions of the purpose of both children and childhood changed over time?
Oh, yeah. See, so that's a big one. I don't think most parents sit around going, golly, I'm living in the midst of this huge historic transition, and maybe that's what the problem is. But it is sort of what the problem is. Right now, is very unusual. It used to be that kids worked, plain and simple. They worked on behalf of the family. They were considered economic assets. We always love them, of course, but the more kids you had, the more advantageous it was to your family because they were bringing in more money. Young boys often out-earned their fathers. Sometime in the progressive era, so let's say between 1890 and 1920, we realized that this was an incredibly immoral arrangement and that child labor ought to have been banned. And thank God we did it because, you know, some kids were working under really Dickensian conditions. The problem is that after that, and really starting after World War II, no one could quite say what the child's function was anymore. We were now in this very strange position as parents. Before, there was something economically rational about the family. You know, I as the mom or I as the dad would provide food, clothing, shelter, moral instruction, whatever it was, and my child in return would kick in some money or some labor on our farm back into the family till. Now, a kid's work is basically going to soccer practice, mm-hmm. or violin lessons or doing their homework and you have to double check their homework. And that means there's way more work for you. So it's as if your kids went from being your help to being your boss in a way. We are now working for them. We're going broke for them. We're pouring tons of hours into cultivating them the way we used to spend tons of hours cultivating our, you know, farms. I mean, we are now meticulously and assiduously cultivating our children to make sure that they have a shot at a middle-class life. But this is just an extremely unusual situation and really exhausting for everyone involved.
So it's ask not what your children can do for you, ask what you can do for your children.
That is precisely it. And I mean, I've been very tempted to use that exact phrase, and the only reason I don't is because it suggests that, like, we never loved our kids.
Yeah.
They never had any sentimental value, and of course they did. But even that has changed, funnily enough, over time. I mean, if you go back to the New England colonies and you look at the sermons that Cotton Mather wrote about children, I mean, he just basically considered them, like, morally defective adults. They were just small people with moral defects. You know, and he had no problem scaring them. He had no problem saying that they were, you know, that they had to fear death and they had to fear their parents and that any child who crossed their parents was in for, you know, a life of eternal damnation or an eternity of damnation. I mean, you know, it was really a different attitude. We did not sentimentalize kids, really, until the 19th century when we, like, invented the high chair, for instance. And then kids were suddenly sitting high at the same level as the rest of us. With, you know, but before that, it was very different. So it's kind of funny.
When did we start using the word parenting as a verb?
I love you for asking that. 1970. It's in the OED, so it must have been used at some point along the way, but it did not enter common usage until 1970. And to me, this says all you need to know, because the point is this. Parenting went from, or I would say that being a parent went from something that one was to something that one did, right, that one does. So it used to be that children simply were. They were alongside you. And like I said, you know, almost until World War II, they were working. So they had their role and you had yours. But now your role isn't just to earn for the family. It's also very specifically to cultivate your kid. And again, that didn't quite used to be the way that we thought about our roles as parents. We thought of ourselves as custodians of traditions, making sure that our kids were positioned to take over our lives, a life that looked a lot like ours. And that's not at all what it looks like now. We are trying to prepare our kids for a future we can't possibly fathom or guess.
And it's interesting because there's a lot of pressure on parents to prepare their kids for this world. Very often it seems that the more people are trying to set them up to avoid any kind of failure, the less kids feel that pressure themselves.
Well, wait, what do you mean the less they feel the pressure?
Well, in other words, kids are sometimes not as invested in building into their childhood every important skill as their parents are.
Oh, yeah, and I think that that's absolutely true. I mean, you can't really discount, like, what a kid's natural tendency might be, which is just to be a kid, you know? And yet, there's a lot of programming that goes on right now. And I think that much of it has to do with the kind of high velocity of technological change that we're all reckoning it with right now. I mean, if you consider that once your kid just inherited your farm, right? Pretty simple. Their life was going to look like yours.
Mm-hmm.
And now you don't know what your kid's going to be doing, so you are signing them up for everything you can think of, just hoping that one thing that they learn will stick. The kid doesn't necessarily want to be doing this. The kid might have very different interests in mind. But because we don't know what kind of future they will be facing, we prepare them for every kind of future to be sure and to cover our bases.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Jennifer Senior, author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jennifer Senior, a contributing editor at New York Magazine and author of the new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. How different, Jennifer, is the experience of parenthood for mothers versus fathers?
It is different. It's considerably different. In most studies, mothers' satisfaction levels rank a little bit lower. They still spend twice as much time caring for their kids as fathers do. This is not per se an unfair thing, because if you look overall at the numbers, men and women work the same number of hours. It's just that men work more paid hours and women work more unpaid hours. I think the difference is that, number one, because most women now work somewhat and many work full-time, what happens is they come home and they're still doing twice as much work at home. So to them, the domestic arrangement division of labor doesn't look like it's particularly fair. The husband comes home, and he's really, really tired, and he wants to decompress, understandably, because he's worked longer hours. But from where the wife sits, she's worked too, and now she's still working, and it looks like her husband is watching Sports Center. Mm-hmm. So this can be a slight recipe for domestic tension. There's the additional fact that women's time with their kids is very different from men's. And I'm not making up any of these numbers. These are all from the American Time Use Survey. They are all from large longitudinal studies done in, you know, out of research labs in Michigan and stuff. Women come home and the shot clock is running. They do the time-sensitive stuff. They do, like, dinner's on the table by 6 o'clock. Then they've got to run the bath. They've got to check the homework. They've got to do X, Y, Z. A lot of men's chores tend to be much more you can choose when you do them. They're more flexible. And the other thing that's very hard to explain, but it's been very well documented, again, by some Michigan sociologists, is that women multitask when they are at home much more than men. In fact, men, when they are home, are much less likely to be multitasking. They're most likely to be monotasking if they're in the house. Whereas women, they just feel like they're in a video game where they're, like, ducking debris. You know, there's this and then there's that. And, you know, if they get a phone call from the office, they're also making dinner and they're, like, sitting on the floor trying to put together a Lego. They're doing seven things at once. And, again, that is just a very different experience of motherhood than an experience of fatherhood.
So when I was a kid, Jennifer, if somebody's mom did not have a job outside the home, they would say, my mom's a housewife. And these days, my kids who have friends whose parents don't work outside the home say, my mom's a stay-at-home mom.
Exactly, which shows how there has been a huge shift in cultural emphasis. Back in Betty Friedan's day, when she wrote The Feminine Mystique, the brilliant thing that she did was she got her hands on a bunch of documents from Madison Avenue that basically said, look, we have all of these college-educated women who are staying at home who might feel a little restless. How are we going to make them feel like being at home is worthwhile? And their answer was to make them feel like domestic scientists. They would say, look, you have to know the difference between floor waxes and oven cleaners and glass cleaners and all these things, and how to get rid of ring around the collar, and that takes a certain skill. You will be a scientist of the house. And the emphasis in those days was on keeping an impeccable house and making sure that meals were splendid and punctual and that everything was clean and that laundry was done every day. Now, no. If you look at the American Time Use Survey, our houses are filthy compared to then. We spend half as much time cleaning our houses as we did in the 1960s, let's say, when Friedan was writing. I mean, it is a dramatic drop-off. Our houses have suffered. But what has gone up is how much time we spend with our children. We now spend more time with our kids than we did in 1965, when most women were not working. And that says all that you need to know, and also about the evolution of the word parent as a verb. We are now actively, immersively playing with our kids, cultivating our kids, being on the floor with them, rather than telling them to go play by themselves and come back at 6 o'clock for dinner, or putting them in a playpen while we made, you know, dinner or did the laundry. Very different model.
So why do so many parents feel guilty about not spending enough time with their children?
I know, that's the great paradox. I think there are a couple of forces that are sort of at work here. One is, you know, I still think that women feel tremendous guilt about working. I think that there are lots of mixed messages that we are sending as a culture to women who work. And they, as a result, sort of engage in all of these compensatory activities, getting down on the floor. The minute they walk through the door, they get down on the floor and they play with their kids because they feel bad about having been away. And Americans clearly have mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, the number of Americans who think that it's absolutely fine if women are the primary breadwinners in a family have gone up.
Mm-hmm.
But what has also gone up is the number of Americans who think that someone needs to be home full-time with their child.
Mm.
So it's like we can't sort that out. I mean, I think we're really wrestling with that question. So I think that's one very simple reason. And by the way, if you survey children, they don't think that their parents are neglecting them. That's what I find so interesting.
Huh.
The one big massive survey of kids who are ages, you know, I guess 3rd grade through 12th, only about 10% said that their mothers didn't spend enough time with them. I mean, it's really a very big mismatch in terms of perception on both ends. I think the other reason is because, you know, we feel like we have to spend this time with them because we're not sure how to prepare them for a changing world. So if you don't know what that involves, if you actually don't know what the terms are of your new job, you're just going to keep trying everything. I mean, that's the problem. If we had an actual script for how to prepare our kids, we would simply do it and then go to bed. You know? We don't know. So we just keep trying.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Eleanor in Fort Worth. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I always enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask about the age range of the people that you interviewed for your book, because my husband and I are close to 80, and my husband's over 80, and we have 6 children. And, of course, when they were all young at home, it was all those things that you're talking about, stressful and more expensive than we can afford, and too much to do. But now that they're all grown and on their own, and we're elderly, they are the greatest joy and the greatest blessing that anyone could ask for. They're our best friends and our support group.
I love that, and I'm so glad you brought that up. It's 100% true. First of all, my book is organized chronologically. So I start with how the kids affect you when your kids are small, and then when they're in those middle years, and then when they're teenagers. But at the very end, I talk about what the overall effect is of having raised children, which is exactly what you are talking about. And the data and also the stories that I heard repeatedly sounded so much like what you just said. Because moment to moment, we know that it's hard. And in fact, there was a researcher who put it beautifully. He described us as having 2 selves. We have an experiencing self, and we have a remembering self. And our experiencing self found raising kids really hard. But our remembering self thinks about having raised kids as the greatest thing that we have ever done. I mean, if you ask the vast majority of Americans who are parents what their greatest source of joy is, they all say their kids. And they even say it when they're in progress. They just have to think about it. At the end of the day when they're lying in bed, they will still say it's their kids. The trick is just sort of optimizing your memories, I think, in a way. I mean, I take a lot of pictures now, and I write down a lot of funny stuff that my kid says because I love remembering how wonderful, like, these things were. And also, I'm willing to bet that some of the hardest moments that you had when you were raising your kids, and golly, you had 6 of them, I mean, that must have been really hard. But I'm guessing that some of the most difficult memories are now enshrined, or the most difficult experiences, I should say, are now enshrined in a very different place in your memory, so that, like, you can be awake with a kid at 3 in the morning and just begging them to go to bed, please go to sleep, please go to sleep. And it's hard at the time. But, you know, 5 years later, what do you remember? You remember the feeling of those arms around your neck, those legs wrapped around your middle. You remember how they smelled. You remember them curled up perfectly on top of you, like they were a koala bear and you were the tree. And I don't know, how do you take that away from anyone? How is that not the greatest thing? You know, it is. So it tracks completely with everything I've read and heard.
Tell us about what you learned about empty nest syndrome, because this is something that the results seem to be very counterintuitive, at least according to what we think our responses will be.
Right. I was really surprised when I read all this. I had assumed that women mourn far more than men when the nest empties. What seems to be emerging, and it's been studied since the 1970s, is that women are less affected by the departure of their children when they go off to college or to get a job than the fathers are. And the reason, if you think about it, does make sense. You just have to kind of give it some thought. Number one, moms spend twice as much time around their kids, which means that while they are very, very attached, they are also very, very anxious on their behalf. They're experiencing a lot of stress. They're very alive to the emotional undercurrents in the house, and really have been living with and channeling that anxiety for many, many years. The other thing is that women, and this is also a surprising finding, are the disciplinarians in families, particularly during the adolescent years. Everyone thinks that it's the fathers. It's not. It's moms. Moms are the ones who are regulating screen time. Moms are the ones who are regulating friendships, saying, who is that kid? Do I have their phone number? How late are you going to be out with them? Where do they live? It's moms. They self-identify as the family disciplinarians in studies, and men identify their wives as the disciplinarians in the house. So there's actually not very much ambiguity about this. So just imagine that you've been playing the bad cop for, you know, a number of years. You've been incredibly enmeshed emotionally in your kid's life, and then they leave. I would not underestimate the hedonic power of relief.
Well, wouldn't do it. And it also makes sense. You know, they typically leave for college if they're, you know, middle class kids at the sort of apex of adolescence. And it turns out we worry so much about teenagers navigating all of that, but it's harder in many cases on parents than on the kids.
Yeah, that was a really interesting, surprising to me. Really surprising finding to me. And I don't want to underestimate or underplay the trauma of adolescence for some teenagers, because it can be really extreme and it can be really hard. And, you know, we all know that there are actual physiological changes going on in adolescence that cannot be denied, that can have, you know, rough outcomes on kids. What's interesting to me is that this one particular researcher named Larry Steinberg at Temple University has done a lot of work on this, and he says that nevertheless, if you look at whose well-being takes a, you know, worse dip, it's not the kids during adolescence, it's the parents, that about 40% of them experience a real downward tick in their well-being and emotional satisfaction, which caused him to sort of, you know, speculate or stipulate that really the crisis in adolescence in a funny way happens to moms and dads more frequently than it happens to kids.
And this is a particularly tough time in terms of parents' relationships to one another as well.
Yes. So here's what's going on. Your kid is no longer racing through the living room to come see you when you walk through the door because your kid has other more interesting things to do. Your kid is busy individuating and becoming his or her own person. So all that fuel you were silently getting for years from your kid who is racing toward you, mm-hmm. you are now not getting. So who are you looking to get that fuel? Your spouse.
Right.
Or maybe your job, or maybe your friends, or maybe your religious community. Where you're looking elsewhere for it. And if those things are not strong, you are going to have some kind of crisis on your hands, right? I mean, I think what happens is that a kid's adolescence sort of exposes all the holes in a parent's life, and very often those holes can be in a marriage. The other thing is that parents have really high-stakes fights when their kids are adolescents. I mean, you're not, like, fighting about who got up with them last and fed them. And you're not fighting about whether or not you're doing a good job diversifying their foods and making sure they eat enough peas or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You are now having arguments about whether or not they are moral and productive and they have a good work ethic and all these things. That can just be brutal. Oh, and let's not forget, kids are now starting to look like grown-ups, right? So I've had family therapists tell me things like, you know, that a husband and a wife will come into their office and they will say, well, my kid is being kind of lazy, just like my husband, you know. And that's, I mean, that's tough stuff.
Yeah.
That's not pretty.
And, of course, there is the, I suppose, the added conflict that adolescents who are, as you say, individuating, bring into the family because they want to do things their own way. And so the level of parent-child conflict is increased as well.
Yeah, it reaches its peak time between, like, 8th and 10th grades, according to most of the literature. And, yeah, the problem is that you've got somebody who is a little bit deceptive in terms of who they are neurologically. On the one hand, they are better able to think and to reason than they ever have been. They are thinking for the first time about themselves in the third person. They are thinking about the kind of person they want to be. They are reasoning better and thinking, you know, abstractly much better. At the same time, the funny thing about the adolescent brain is that its prefrontal cortex is not yet finished developing. And the prefrontal cortex is the part of our brain that controls our impulses, and it's in charge of our executive function. It still does do a lot of reasoning for us. So in some ways, you still are not dealing with an entirely rational creature, and also you're dealing with someone who is flooded with so much dopamine, like you'll never have that any of that again in your life. You won't have as much dopamine as you have during adolescence, and dopamine is like a feel-good hormone.
Mm-hmm.
So they are motivated by feeling good about stuff and rewards. So imagine having to tamp that down. That's hard.
Jennifer Senior is my guest. She's a contributing editor at New York Magazine and author of the new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to New York Magazine contributing editor Jennifer Senior, author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Join us by sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, by emailing think@kera.org, or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So Jennifer, Samuel Johnson called second marriages the triumph of hope over experience. Why does anybody have a second child?
why does anybody have children? I mean, they have them because, you know, they provide unrivaled joy, because you want a family, because you want to serve, and you want your life to be about, you know, having moral obligations to other people. And, you know, having a second child can be very nice. I mean, you suddenly have a family. You know, you have like a whole unit to suddenly, you know, contend with. Your children have playmates. In fact, you could argue that some of the pressure that's been intensely focused on you keeping your kid occupied can now, you know, kind of be spread around. I mean, you know, I don't think there's... I think if we sort of reframe this question, you know, why do you have kids? I mean, it's very clear that the moments of transcendence are a big piece of it, but also because we want to do something larger than ourselves, and we want to place ourselves in the service of a higher goal than simply, you know, moment-to-moment gratification. That's why you do it.
Well, and it's interesting, you know, your book does also talk about joy, and there is joy in parenting. It's just different maybe from pleasure, and it's important, I suppose, to remember that those two things are not exactly the same.
Oh, they're totally different. Yeah, I mean, pleasure is like eating a Snickers bar. Pleasure is ephemeral. It feels good for a bit. It's focused on the self. You know, it's very inward. Joy, and I'm using now the definition of George Valiant, who's this really wonderful psychiatrist who in another life would have been a poet. Joy, as he points out, is outwardly focused, and it is about being connected to somebody, and it's all about connection. And his argument, which I have always found startling and beautiful, is that joy in some ways is even harder to tolerate than sadness, because you love something so much and are so deeply connected to it that it's impossible to think about this person, impossible, without thinking about losing that person. Mm. I mean, it's implicit in it because you are so connected that it suddenly seems fragile, which explains why, you know, you will frequently hear a parent talk about standing over the crib of their sleeping child and staring at this child and being in awe and then suddenly being overcome by fear. Like, oh my God, what if something happens? And that's because they're feeling joy. They are so in love with their kid. Suddenly it occurs to them that they might not have them. Hmm. And, you know, I think that's the whole ball game to me. You know what he said? He called it, he said that joy was grief inside out. Hmm. I've never forgotten that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to David in Grapevine. Hey, David.
Hi, how are y'all doing?
Great, thank you.
I have a question for you. So I became a parent later than most people. I was in my 40s when my first was born. And so I spent a couple of decades watching parenting as an adult, and it seems over the past 20 years, you have helicopter parents and you know, just parenting has gotten so much more involved and so much more perceptibly difficult than it's been. So I'm just wondering if you have noticed that in your research, if that may also affect, you know, happiness as a parent and if that's changed over the past few decades.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that, of course, it has. It's hard to imagine how it couldn't affect your happiness as a parent because among the other things that helicoptering requires is being there all the time. You are not having any time to yourself, right? So all that hovering is coming at great personal expense in terms of your emotional energy and your time. So that's going to have an effect on you. What I'm interested in is whether it also has an effect on the kid. And it seems like there is an emerging body of literature that suggests, as you might expect, that it's not necessarily to the kid's benefit because if kids are constantly hovered over, they're never going to learn to be resilient. They're never going to learn to trust their own resources. They're never going to be able to fall back on what they've got because somebody's always there to catch them. And so it does sort of stand to reason that maybe backing off a bit would be better for both you and for the kid. But I will say that I am very sympathetic to what got us all to this place. I mean, I think helicoptering, as I sort of said earlier on the show, I think we do it because women feel guilty that they're working, so they feel like they've got to compensate and be around their kids. I think we helicopter because we are unsure about how to prepare our kids for the future, so we just sit there and do everything we possibly can with them. I think that we are paranoid about crime against our kids, even though it's at an all-time low, because you know, there's public sex offender registries in some states, including yours, including Texas. And I think that makes people scared. So they helicopter for that reason, you know, thinking otherwise their kids are going to be kidnapped. You know, it exaggerates one's sense of safety. So there are all sorts of reasons that kind of conspire to make us hover. You just have to be very careful and guard against them, I think.
Did you find parents were reluctant to talk about their frustrations for fear of being perceived somehow as not loving their children?
You know, I did not. I know that sounds strange, but no, I didn't. I mean, I was very lucky. You know, I spent the first part of my book in Minnesota going through a statewide program that takes something like 90,000 parents per year of kids who are 0 to 5. And half of, so the parents show up and they spend half of their time playing with their kids in a giant room with professionals. And then the parents disappear and just talk with one another. And their, once parents are all in a room and they're alone together and they have an instructor who makes it feel safe, they're pretty honest. And I chose among those parents the ones who are the most honest, right? That's one of the guidelines I used. I did part of my book in Texas, as I'm sure you know. I was in Houston and the surrounding suburbs. And again, I just kind of decided that what I was going to do was call parents and read them out. And I found that if I just started conversations and perfectly, like, tell me about what's hard about this, they would start to talk. I mean, there's a pent-up need to want to talk about what's hard. I think that actually the people who react the most defensively to this question might secretly be harboring the most ambivalence about being parents. I think if you are unambivalent about your kid and you love your kid to pieces, you can speak pretty honestly about what ails you because your love for that kid is never in question, ever.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Randall in Coppell. Hey, Randall.
Hi. Just a quick question, actually 2 points to kind of make. First, in regards to at the beginning of the program, you talked about how the mom has to take on two jobs. I'm just wondering whether you have any statistics or any information on how that role has been changing. Basically, the father is working a regular job, happens to be regional, but then he also has the responsibility to take care of the kids and how that plays into parenting and the marriage. The second question is how social media and all these little fancy gadgets that we have play into parenting or play into the relationship that parents have with each other.
Those are both great questions. Okay, I'll answer the father one first, the fatherhood one. You're right. Fathers are more involved than they've ever been. The fact that the American Time Use Survey shows that on average women are still doing twice as much childcare means that there's still an imbalance, but I don't want to suggest for 10 seconds that fathers aren't way more involved than they ever were or that their own fathers were. And it's also now men who are reporting more work-life conflict, work-life balance issues than women. Men really want to be home more for their kids. So I think they're encountering resistance in the office frequently to be able to get home on time and do what they need to do. I think they want to do more often. So, yeah, I don't mean for 10 seconds to suggest that men wouldn't be more immersively involved as they could. I think they would, and I think that that's changing very rapidly. I'd love to know what the time use statistics will say in even 10 years from now, because I bet they'll be different. And as far as gadgetry, oh, what a good question, because, of course, we all work differently now, so, of course, we're going to parent differently. And one of the things that came up repeatedly when I talked to parents was email. And this is how it would come up. It would turn out that parents guiltily felt like their kids were interrupting them while they were doing their email, rather than feeling like their email was interrupting them when they were playing with their children. Because we are now capable of working all the time, which means we are capable of feeling guilty all the time. And means we are capable of subdividing our attention all the time. And it is incredibly hard. I mean, it used to be that if you got an interruption from your office, you know, at 8 o'clock at night, it was because you were a doctor. You worked for the ER, you know. And now many middle-class parents feel like they are constantly having to field emails. So that absolutely contributes to the kind of sense of time fracturing at home. It makes it hard to focus. And then there's, of course, all the gadgetry that kids use that, on the one hand, can be really great, and they're going to grow up in a world of gadgets, so they should be fluent in gadgetry as far as I'm concerned. But it also means that, like, if you want to sit there and regulate their screen time so that they learn how to tolerate boredom, you better, you know, it's hard to say that if you yourself are on your iPhone all day long. So, I mean, I often catch myself in these moments of, like, terrible hypocrisy. And, yeah, it sort of plays out in marriages, too. I mean, how many times can you think about, you know, you and your spouse getting in bed and you each have your own laptop or iPad and you're each watching or listening to your own thing? I mean, it's complicated. I mean, these are new technologies and we haven't developed a very sophisticated way of dealing with them.
Those devices also give us like a 24/7 access to information that allows us to compare our children to other people's children, right? Which is a road no one should go down, but there it is.
It is the one thing I am so proud of. I don't count myself as the most disciplined person, but I never look at that stuff because it's fake. It's fake. We should not do it to ourselves.
Yeah.
All those Facebook pictures are fake, you know, that they've been curated to make families look like they're having perfect moments all the time. You can go on parenting message boards and on Urban Baby and on, you know, all these different websites, and there will be always be some crowd that will be hectoring and always some expert that will be telling you that every choice you have made is the wrong one. And that plague of contradictions, you have to tune it out. What it says to me is that no one is sure what parenting is now that we live in this world of very high velocity change and our kids don't work for us anymore and we are responsible for our kids' happiness. We don't know how to do it. So we look left and we look right and we come up and go, God, I must be doing everything all wrong. We're not. We're all doing it as best as we can. We're working without a script.
Do you ever think that our awareness of the importance of early childhood actually stresses us out more? Because, you know, my husband and I will joke about scarring our kids for life, and we hope we're not doing that, but it is kind of in the back of our minds.
I know, mine too, and I talk about it all the time with my cousin who's a pediatrician to try and figure out what the line is between, you know, do you traumatize a kid by merely yelling at them and losing your temper, or does it have to be much worse, or, you know, what... And I think that what's interesting is that there's now this emerging body of literature that shows that really adolescence has been given short shrift in terms of its impact on our future identities. It's very tempting. It was very tempting for decades to say that early childhood was the most meaningful window in terms of a kid's emotional development because it's really easy to start studying kids from the moment they're born. You have an automatic cohort. It's much harder to do it when kids are in the middle of their lives and when the brain is already under construction. But, I mean, I think we have to be very careful and not over-assign, you know, what happens in those years, like all this weight. I know that we have a lot of work done on this subject. I don't think we have all the work done on this subject to feel totally comfortable yet.
Has this research affected your approach to being a mother?
I mean, yeah, no. You know, when you're writing a book, you tend to be very preoccupied, so it makes you not as good of a parent anyway, if I were to be completely honest. You know, you get kind of sucked into this big project. So some things were very useful that I learned. I learned that it is best not to passively, aggressively duke it out with your husband on the weekend for free time, but to actually discuss it ahead of schedule. Parents who actually, while they're pregnant, you know, couples who actually discuss who will do what before the baby is born, and they really hammer out a very detailed contract with fine print, are happier than those who wing it. So I try and do that in my marriage. I mean, we didn't do that before the kid came along, but I try and do it now where we have, like, kind of informal contracts as we go, like, I'm going to do this and you're going to do this, and that way everything will get done and no one feels like they're getting the shaft.
Yeah.
I also try and, as I said, I try and keep more archives. I try to make sure that my remembering self is very active. I take more pictures, I write down things that my kid says, because if one of the greatest pleasures that one has in being a parent is being able to remember all the good stuff, you want to have as much good stuff to trigger your memories as possible.
Jennifer Senior is a contributing editor at New York Magazine and author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Jennifer, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you. It's been great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.